Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Today, well, we're tackling a question. It's one many people maybe only hit during a midlife crisis.
Wait, or maybe when things feel overwhelming?
But Judy Krishnamurti, he insists, no, you need to ask this every single morning. We're diving into his key work. What are you doing with your life?
And it really is perhaps the most radical question you can ask yourself, because it doesn't care about your resume, your retirement plan, none of that.
Yeah, the external stuff.
Exactly. Krishnamurti just challenges the very foundation of, well, modern existence. He argues quite forcefully that the root of all our human suffering, you know, the conflict, anxiety, fear, it doesn't actually come from out there.
Not from our circumstances,
like
job stress or politics.
No, he says it comes from inside, from our internal conditioning. Conditioning imposed by, and this is his uncompromising phrase, a profoundly sick society. Wow. A profoundly sick society.
Yeah.
That's strong.
It is. He doesn't pull any punches.
So the central question isn't about, you know, what job you have or how much you earn. It's about authenticity, really.
Mm-hmm.
Are you genuinely living your life? Or are you just kind of running a program, a script written by others, tradition, fear, culture?
That's it. It's like a very loud alarm clock, this book.
It sounds like it. And to really get the weight of that challenge, I suppose we need to understand the person behind it. His background.
Absolutely. His own life story is key to understanding his perspective.
Okay, so let's unpack that. Jiddu Krishnamurti, born in British India, 1895. Quite a unique figure in philosophy, wouldn't you say?
Incredibly unique. I mean, his story is almost unbelievable. It's defined by this massive rejection of power and authority.
How so?
Well, as a boy, he was identified by the Theosophical Society, a really influential spiritual group at the time.
Right.
And they basically groomed him. Extensively. They believed he was destined to be this messianic figure, the world teacher.
World teacher. Wow.
Yeah. They created a huge global organization just for him. The Order of the Star in the East put him on the highest spiritual pedestal imaginable.
Okay. So he's set up to be this major global figure.
And then comes 1929, his defining moment. He stands up, gives this incredibly dramatic speech, and just dissolves the whole organization.
Dissolves it. The worldwide organization built for him.
Gone. Rejected the title, the pedestal, the authority, everything. And that's when he declared those famous words. Truth is a pathless land.
Truth is a pathless land. What does that really mean in its context?
It's foundational. It means you can't arrive at truth through any organized religion, any guru, any method, any path laid out by someone else.
Well, I see.
And because he dismantled the highest spiritual authority offered to him, he speaks from this place of, well, absolute freedom, or at least that's the claim. His insights aren't from books or tradition.
They're from direct perception, self-investigation.
Exactly. He is essentially the ultimate anti-guru. He constantly insisted, look for yourself. Because anyone claiming to lead you, in his view, actually destroys your own intelligence.
Okay, that really sets the stage. So when you pick up what are you doing with your life, you shouldn't expect comfort.
Definitely not comfort. It's not a self-help book. Zero steps to success or happiness provided.
So what is it then?
It's more like a philosophical mirror, a very intense one. It's designed to provoke really deep, sometimes uncomfortable self-inquiry.
Aimed particularly at people questioning the usual path. Success, security, that sort of thing.
Precisely. People may be standing at a crossroads wondering if the conventional game is worth playing.
So what's the core argument? The main problem he identifies?
The problem, he says, is the fragmented mind. That's the root of human conflict, both internal and external.
Fragmented mind. What does he mean by that?
He describes this constant inner division, a split between what we actually are in any given moment, the reality, maybe jealousy, anger, confusion.
The messy stuff.
Yeah, the messy stuff. And what we think we should be, the ideal, the image, the perfect, non-jealous, always loving person society tells us to be.
Ah, okay. So I feel angry, but I think I shouldn't be angry. That gap.
That gap is the conflict. It's the friction. The internal turmoil is born right there, in that space between what is and what should be.
And that internal war, he connects that to external problems.
Directly. He argues this is why all our external attempts to fix things, political reforms, social movements, new ideologies, they're ultimately doomed.
Doomed. Why?
Because they ignore the root cause. They tinker with the symptoms, but the disease is the disordered mind itself, tangled up in its own thoughts, and the ego, the self.
Right. Treating the branches, not the root.
Exactly. So the solution he offers has to be internal. And it's While it's radical, and he admits, quite difficult.
Which is.
The path, if you can call it that, is self-knowledge, but not intellectual knowledge. It's gained through direct, moment-to-moment, choiceless awareness.
Okay, choiceless awareness. That's a phrase that needs unpacking. Choiceless sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Passive. If I don't choose, how do I do anything?
It's a tricky term. It doesn't mean being passive like a vegetable. It means observing reality, what's happening inside you and outside you, without immediately imposing your judgment, your interpretation, your desire to change it.
So not analyzing it or trying to fix it.
Not initially. If you feel anger, for instance, choiceless awareness isn't about saying anger is bad, I must stop it, or I'm justified in being angry. It's simply watching the mechanics of the anger.
But like the physical feeling.
Yeah.
The thoughts that come with it.
The tension in your jaw, the heat rising, the aggressive thoughts flashing through your mind. You just observe it all without suppression, without justification, without naming it good or bad.
And that leads to freedom. Just watching.
That seeing of what is, without the distortion of your judgment or desire, is what brings clarity. You stop creating conflict with the reality of the moment. That, for him, is the beginning of real intelligence and peace.
Okay, let's try to apply that lens, that choiceless awareness, to some concrete areas. He talks a lot about ambition and livelihood, right? Modern obsession.
Oh, yes. And he is absolutely scathing about ambition.
Scathing how?
He sees it as fundamentally destructive. It's a competitive process, always rooted in comparison. You want to be better than some ruthless self-knowledge, he'd say. You have to ask, does my work thrive on division, exploitation, creating desire for things people don't need? Think about working for, say, an arms manufacturer. Or maybe a social media company designing addictive algorithms. Or a corporation knowingly polluting.
The salary doesn't make it right.
Irrelevant in his view. True work flows from understanding yourself and maybe even a love for the action itself, not just the reward or recognition it brings.
That's what, yeah, that forces a serious look at how we participate in that sick society he mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, moving from work. Relationships. Another minefield.
Definitely. He suggests that many, maybe most, relationships are actually based on mutual need, on comfort, on trying to escape our own deep-seated loneliness.
Ouch. That sounds a bit cynical.
It's stark, but his core point is about the images we create. He says we rarely relate to the actual living human being in front of us.
We relate to? What then?
To the image we've built of them in our minds. A composite of memories, past hurts, expectations, hopes for the future.
Like a mental file photo.
Exactly. And the moment the real person deviates from that comfortable image we hold.
Irritation, frustration, conflict.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. So for him, true love isn't attachment. It isn't dependency. It can only exist when that image-making, demanding self, the ego, is absent, which is, well, a very high bar.
Understatement. Okay, yeah. Ego, images.
Yeah.
This seems connected to another huge topic he tackles, fear.
Yes, fear. The great shadow, as you say. And he pinpoints the root of psychological fear, not the instinctive fear of a speeding bus, but the inner anxiety.
Like the chronic stuff. Worrying about the future, regretting the past.
That kind of fear, he says, is born from the collaboration between thought and time.
Thought and time. Okay, how does that work? This is where it gets really interesting, I think.
Well, thought is essentially the response of memory, isn't it? It takes past experiences, hurts, failures, successes, and projects them onto the future.
Creating scenarios.
Yeah.
What if?
Exactly. I failed that presentation last month, so I'll definitely bomb this one next week. Or I feel lonely now, so I'm doomed to be lonely forever. It's the thought about the past or future event that generates the fear now.
So thought uses psychological time, past and future, to create fear in the present.
That's his analysis. And the radical antidote he proposes isn't courage, not trying to be brave or suppress the fear.
No, whoop them.
It's, again, that awareness. Observe the fear directly, completely. When it arises, allow yourself to feel the physical sensations, the tight chest, the churning stomach.
Without running away from it mentally, without judging it.
Yes, without trying to escape, analyze, justify, or even name it. Just pure, choiceless attention to the raw sensation of fear. Without adding the fuel of thought and resistance.
And he claims that allows it to dissolve.
That total attention without the energy of trying to do something about it is what allows the fear's energy to dissipate naturally. You see it for what it is, sensation and thought, and it loses its grip.
Okay, that's a lot to digest on fear, ambition, relationships. Let's try and connect these pieces by looking at some of the big overarching themes in his work. What are the core messages?
Well, one of the most profound and maybe hardest to grasp initially is theme one. The observer is the observed.
The observer is the observed. Sounds a bit Zen Koan-like.
It can feel that way. We're all conditioned to think there's a me, the thinker, the observer, the controller, separate from my thoughts and feelings, which are the observed.
Right. Like, I am feeling angry, there's me, and there's the anger. Two separate things.
Exactly. If I feel frustrated with someone, I think, okay, I, the observer, need to deal with this frustration, the observed emotion. But Krishnamurti says, no, that separation is an illusion.
An illusion. How?
He argues the thinker is the thought. The entity that judges the anger is part of the anger itself. You can't actually separate the experiencer from the experience at that psychological level.
Whoa. Okay, so if the observer is the observed, what difference does knowing that make?
Realizing this, truly seeing it, collapses the internal conflict. If there's no separate me trying to manage, fight, or control the feeling from some psychological distance,
then you just watch the whole phenomenon, the anger, the judging thought, all of it, as one process.
Yes, with complete attention. And that ends the huge energy drain of that internal warfare. The struggle stops.
Okay, that's huge. What's theme two?
Theme two is perhaps the one that causes the most resistance, the rejection of all authority. All psychological authority, that is.
He was really uncompromising on this, wasn't he?
Absolutely relentless. He insisted that following any guru, any scripture, any ideology, even his own books, he'd say.
Even his own words.
Yes. Following anything external destroys your innate intelligence and just perpetuates your conditioning. The only valid authority in the quest for truth is your own direct perception, your own diligent inquiry.
Society runs on authority. Experts, leaders, traditions.
He saw all reliance on external psychological authority as dependency. And a dependent mind, he argued, can never, ever be free. It's always looking for validation or instruction from outside.
That is a massive challenge to how most of us live and think. Okay, what's theme three?
Theme three ties into this. Freedom from the known.
Freedom from the known. What's the known?
The known is basically your entire psychological past. It's the accumulation of memories, experiences, prejudices, conclusions, beliefs, successes, failures, everything you've learned and concluded about yourself and the world.
So our conditioning.
Exactly. And true freedom, he says, isn't about achieving some future state. It's liberation from the known, psychologically speaking, because it's the past, the known, that filters and distorts your perception of the present.
So freedom is approaching each moment fresh, without the baggage of the past coloring what you see.
Yes. A mind that's free from the known can see what is without judgment, without the screen of past experience. It requires constant vigilance, constant self-awareness.
These are enormous ideas. And he had such a direct way of putting things. Maybe sharing a few quotes could help capture that flavor.
Yes. His statements are often incredibly direct, almost stark. Let's start with the one that defined his whole approach. Truth is a pathless land. You cannot approach it by any path whatsoever, by any religion, by any sect.
Undiluted self-reliance, basically. Mm. Direct discovery or nothing.
Precisely. And then there's his critique of just fitting in. It is no measure of health to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society.
Oof. Yeah, that one lands hard. It really questions our idea of normalcy.
Doesn't it? And finally, one that points towards the how, the mechanism we've been discussing. The ability to observe without evaluating is the highest form of intelligence.
Clear perception. Seeing without the immediate overlay of judgment, preference, condemnation. That's the key.
That's what he points to as the highest intelligence, yes.
Okay, so we have these incredibly radical, potentially life-altering ideas, but they can feel very abstract. How do we bring this down to earth? How can you actually apply some of this in, you know, everyday life?
That's the crucial question, isn't it? Let's think about education or career. Instead of just learning to pass exams or climb the ladder.
Which is driven by ambition, comparison.
Right. His insights encourage learning purely for the sake of understanding, driven by curiosity. And professionally, it shifts the focus. Instead of just what's the next promotion or what pays the most, the question becomes,
what do I actually love doing? Or maybe, what is the function I'm performing in society? Does this work contribute to conflict or cooperation?
Exactly. It prompts a deeper inquiry than just status or salary.
That's a fundamental shift.
Yeah.
Okay, what about managing emotions? The daily grind of anxiety, frustration, stress. How does choiceless awareness work there, practically?
Okay, let's take a concrete example. Say you're feeling really anxious before a big presentation or a difficult conversation.
Yeah, familiar feeling.
Instead of immediately labeling it bad anxiety and trying to push it away or distract yourself or pump yourself up with false confidence.
We observe it.
You practice watching the actual physical sensations, the cold hands, the knot in the stomach, the racing heart, the tense shoulders. You observe the anxious thoughts flashing by. But you do it without adding a second layer of thought about the anxiety, like, I hate feeling this way, or this means I'm going to fail.
You just watch the raw data of the feeling.
Yes. And by not feeding it with the energy of resistance or judgment, you deny it the fuel it needs to sustain itself. You simply see it clearly, and often its intensity lessens, its grip loosens.
It takes practice, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. It's not a quick fix.
Yeah.
But it's a different way of relating to difficult emotions.
And what about just daily interactions? Can we apply this there?
Definitely. He spoke about meditation not just as sitting on a cushion, but as all-day awareness. A really practical, brilliant example he gave is the art of listening.
The art of listening.
Think about most conversations. While the other person is talking, what are we usually doing?
Formulating our reply. Thinking about what we want to say next. Judging what they're saying.
Exactly. Our minds are busy preparing, reacting, evaluating. The art of listening, in his sense, means giving total attention to the speaker. Listening without simultaneously formulating your response, without agreeing or disagreeing internally, just hearing them fully.
Wow. That simple act sounds revolutionary, actually. Most communication probably isn't like that at all.
It's incredibly rare. To simply listen without the self constantly intervening with its opinions and plans is a profound act of awareness.
This has been, well, truly a radical deep dive. Challenging stuff. As we start to wrap up, what's the one thing that really sticks with you from exploring Krishnamurti's ideas in this book? Your main takeaway?
For me, I think it's the absolute indivisible link he draws between our inner world and the outer world. The chaos, the violence, the competition we see out there isn't separate from us. It's a direct projection, a reflection of the fragmentation and disorder within the individual mind.
So changing the world really starts inside.
That's his unwavering point. The most radical, the most effective action for genuine social change isn't necessarily joining a movement or fighting an external enemy. It's the individual psychological revolution, transforming oneself.
What I found most powerful, maybe even exhilarating, is how the book just refuses to give you answers or safety nets.
Right. It puts everything back on you.
Completely. It basically hands the key, the map, everything back to you, the listener, and insists that if you want to live authentically, you have to drop all the psychological crutches.
No gurus, no easy belief systems.
No dependencies. You have to stand on your own feet and face the reality of what is moment by moment with clarity and intelligence.
Yeah.
It's demanding, but also incredibly empowering in a strange way.
It really is. Which, I suppose, leads us to a final provocative thought for you, the listener, to maybe ponder.
Okay, let's hear it.
If Krishnamurti is right, if the very search for psychological security, whether we seek it in a job title, a particular relationship, a rigid ideology, or even in spiritual practices, if that search itself is precisely what creates the insecurity and conflict we're trying to escape,
yeah,
then what would it actually mean? What would it feel like to truly, deeply embrace complete uncertainty in your life, to live without seeking that inner security at all?
Wow. Okay. That's definitely something to chew on. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.